Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, June the 18th, these are our main stories. Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un sign a strategic partnership agreement during the Russian leader's first visit to North Korea in more than two decades. Cyril Ramaphosa is sworn in for a second time as president of South Africa. The gaming chipmaker NVIDIA becomes the world's most valuable company. Also in this podcast, the dangerously shifting patterns of the world's warming weather, and
when it's in its peak, it smells really bad. It's like an animal's crawled into the glasshouse and died in the corner. It's a really strong, foul stench.
The flower that stinks of rotting meat. President Vladimir Putin and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are regarded by much of the world as pariahs. But today, they were the centre of global attention. Mr. Putin was in Pyongyang, his first visit there in more than two decades. And Mr. Kim pulled out all the stops with a red carpet welcome, big hugs, crowds and a grand military parade. They then spent 2 hours in discussions, which resulted in the signing of a comprehensive strategic partnership treaty, which, according to Russian media, includes a mutual defence clause. During the talks, Mr. Kim said he fully supported Russia and its invasion of Ukraine.
The situation continues to be complex and changing all the time. We take this opportunity to confirm once again that we will continue to strengthen strategic communication with the Russian leadership and Russia, even in the complex global geopolitical situation, and continue to unconditionally support all of Russia's policies.
This was President Putin's response.
We very much appreciate your consistent and permanent support of the Russian policy, including in the Ukrainian issue. I mean in our struggle against the hegemonic imperialist policy imposed for decades by the United States and its satellites in relation to the Russian Federation.
For more on the agreement they've signed, I spoke to Vitaly Shevchenko from BBC Monitoring.
The most striking and important detail came from Vladimir Putin, who spoke in reasonably vague terms about military cooperation between Russia and North Korea. He said that Russia is not ruling out military technical cooperation, which in Russian official parlance means defense cooperation. And also he said, as part of the comprehensive strategic partnership deal that the two countries signed, they agreed to provide mutual assistance in case of aggression against either North Korea or Russia, which again means defense. Now, this raises all sorts of questions, given that North Korea is subject to a host of United Nations sanctions that ban weapons trade with North Korea. So how exactly is Russia going to implement this defense cooperation? That's going to be interesting. And also, questions will be asked and people will be watching keenly whether Russia has secured any further agreements to obtain weapons, such as artillery shells and possibly ballistic missiles from North Korea. There's nothing about that was said in the press conference given by the two leaders or in Russian or North Korean state TV, possibly because this kind of trade is banned by the UN.
And what do you think that Russia wants out of this? Does it want weapons for the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, there's that. And also, there are more symbolic reasons for Putin to go to North Korea and for Russian state TV to trumpet this visit. The message to audiences in Russia and abroad is that Vladimir Putin has friends. He's got countries abroad which he can visit and be welcomed. And that's why Russian state TV, as we speak, it's savoring every minute detail of this lavish welcome that's been afforded to the Russian president in Pyongyang. The reason is that both North Korea and Russia, they're one of the most heavily sanctioned countries in the world. The West is making efforts to ostracize them. But the message sent by Putin is, look, I'm free to travel. I've got friends.
And how do you think this tie-up will be viewed in the West? We've already heard that China is keeping a very close eye on it. What do you think America and the rest of the world will think?
Well, it's bad news for America and its allies, such as Ukraine, especially if Russia gets more ammunition and weapons from North Korea. And Washington has said that it will do all it can to put an end to such supplies from North Korea and Iran as well. But what exactly it can do is less than clear, given that there's evidence of North Korean munitions being used in Ukraine.
Vitaly Shevchenko. And now to the South African capital, Pretoria. The sound there of the long and elaborate ceremony that saw Cyril Ramaphosa sworn in for his second term as president. He'll head a coalition after the African National Congress reached a deal with its rival, the Democratic Alliance, following the ANC loss of seats in last month's election. Our correspondent, Barbara Pletasher, who's in Johannesburg, watched the events unfold.
There have been foreign dignitaries attending. There's been a military flyby. There's been a battalion march past and a 21-gun salute. Everyone dressed in very sort of colorful clothing, and also on the lawn in front of the building, various groups singing and dancing. So it has been quite a festive day.
And what did Mr. Ramaphosa say in his address? I mean, what tone did he strike?
I would say it was both optimistic but also solemn. He said that this was a moment of profound significance, the beginning of a new era. And he was referring to, of course, the government of power sharing that the ANC has been forced to agree to because it lost its majority. But he acknowledged that the reason it lost its majority was because voters were angry with the ANC for its economic failures and the allegations of corruption in essence. He sort of said humbly, I've heard what you've said, and this new coalition is committed to reversing inequalities and growing the economy. But he also made some warnings. He said the country was polarized, riven with deep divisions between the haves and the have-nots, and that if these were not addressed, they could turn into instability. So he said, we have to either choose to move forward together or risk losing all we have built. So quite a bit of time spent on the need for unity and the threats to it, also warning South Africans to reject any efforts to sow doubt and cynicism and undermine our institutions.
Well, you mentioned the economy, the haves and have-nots. I mean, how bad is it in South Africa now? You're there. How bad is it?
Well, there was progress under the ANC, the African National Congress, after the end of apartheid. Its black empowerment programs and social welfare did lift millions of black people out of poverty. But what you have now is you still have many of those inequalities firmly entrenched in terms of where people live and what their opportunities are. And you have a very high unemployment rate. It's the highest in the world, at least the recorded highest, and especially for young people. You have services that aren't working, water, electricity that aren't reliable. You have infrastructure that's not working. And a lot of that is blamed on corruption in high ranks or appointing people who weren't competent to the job. So there are a lot of things that South Africans are angry about, and many, I think, do want to see this coalition, although it is unusual to have these two rivals working together to at least try to get the economy back on track.
Barbara Pletasher. So, what lies ahead? Well, Tessa Dooms is director of the South African think tank Rivonia Circle. She says President Ramaphosa now faces a big challenge in crafting and maintaining a coalition government.
It's actually going to be very interesting to see if President Ramaphosa has the leadership ability to bring together people from outside his party when he's struggled to do so from within. People in the ANC have argued that Cyril Ramaphosa has done a good job of getting people out who did not agree with him. But what that has done is actually weakened the ANC in that you've seen the creation of another ANC breakaway, the biggest one we've seen in the history of democratic South Africa. And so dispelling people and alienating people has not worked. And so his ability to really unify the ANC hasn't worked out that well. So when it comes to bringing together other parties around the table, who are not only outside the ANC, but are quite different, ideologically different in terms of constituencies that they serve, while he's also dealing with a weakened ANC and two opposition parties in the EFF and the MK that are going to give him a hard time, I do think there's going to be a big test of his own leadership in the next few years. I'm not particularly excited at the prospect that he'll be able to corral people together, but it is going to be necessary for him to have a very firm grip on his cabinet going forward. What's going to be the lesson and that needs to be learned is that they're going to have to prioritize policy over position, and they're going to have to prioritize stability over political brinkmanship. We need a lot of maturity here that is policy-based. Once we get to the point that a cabinet is established, we're going to figure out to what extent it's going to be contested at the level of positions and whether those are going to be the big deal breakers or whether policy is going to win over at the end of the day.
Tessa Dooms of the Rivonia Circle think tank. The stock market has a new tech king, Nvidia. Leapfrogging two household names, Microsoft and Apple, Nvidia now controls more than 80% of the market for the chips used in AI systems. Its rise is among the fastest in market history. Just 2 years ago, the company's market valuation was over $400 million. Now, in just 12 months, it's gone from $1 trillion to, wait for it, more than $3 trillion. Stephen Witt writes for The New Yorker and is the author of a new book on NVIDIA. And he's been explaining the firm's giddying rise to Emma Barnett.
Well, we've seen the success of systems like ChatGPT and all these new fantastic tools that are being built. But where do they come from? They have to train. They have to train on AI hardware, and they have to be deployed on AI hardware. And the amount of computing power that they require is absolutely massive, larger really than any other system that's ever been deployed. NVIDIA supplies that hardware. They're the sole supplier in many cases. You can compare it to the gold rush. They're the guys who are selling the shovels.
It's an interesting comparison. It's also for people trying to imagine where those systems are coming from. They perhaps haven't thought about it, but they now will be starting to hear this name and also perhaps the name of the CEO as well, who I understand has become a bit of a rock star to some.
Jensen Huang has had one of the most successful runs in business history. Actually, for years, he was a vendor of gaming hardware. NVIDIA was classically a supplier of kind of graphics hardware for games like World of Warcraft or Call of Duty. But what they found was that running these games is one of the hardest things a computer could do. Jensen intuited that these circuits could be repurposed for scientific uses and found that when AI came along, it was the perfect match. About 10 or 11 years ago, he bet his entire company on this concept, pushed in all the chips. It was a long shot bet, but now it paid off.
And in terms of, you know, some talking that as often as can be at the moment with these sorts of companies about a bubble, but this isn't a bubble in the sense of it's a profit-making business, isn't it?
It makes an extraordinary amount of profit. It makes a fantastic product that people love. Its revenues and profitability are absolutely through the roof. That's driving the stock higher. Now, I will say, in the past month or so, it's gotten a little frothy. And a lot of people are contacting me saying, you know, I've never traded the stock before. I don't know what they do, but I just bought some shares because it went up so much. So there's a little bit of mania going on there. But, you know, Jensen describes what he's building as an AI factory where data goes in and intelligence comes out. And if that's true, it could have an absolutely revolutionary impact on the economy and could transform productivity for decades to come.
Yes, although that's a whole other discussion, I suppose, about where that leaves us in our workforce. But in terms of those household names, the Microsofts, the Apples, are they looking at upping their competition in this area, trying to catch up? Can it catch up?
Microsoft is not a competitor of NVIDIA's. In fact, they're one of their largest customers. That's true with Apple, too. The reason that NVIDIA is doing so well is they functionally have almost no competition at all.
Right.
They build these AI microchips, and they really kind of wandered off into a field by themselves a long time ago and just started building them before there were really any customers around to buy them. When the customers finally showed up, it was a bonanza for them, but it meant that they have practically, you know, no competitors. Actually, Microsoft stock and Apple stock both are up in sympathy with NVIDIA. NVIDIA has helped those companies to grow.
Stephen Witt. Still to come, we've never lived next to rubbish. I cry just like any other grandmother would over her grandchildren being sick.
The waste causes diseases. We suffer from vomiting, diarrhea, and itchy skin.
As the conflict in Gaza continues, the threat to civilians posed by huge piles of stinking, uncollected rubbish.
I'm Krassi Twig from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, is the Islamic State group a threat once more? 10 years since they declared the establishment of a caliphate, the jihadists are claiming to be behind a spate of recent terror attacks.
You cannot ignore the danger of IS. When you're not looking, they will rebound and regroup.
The Global Jigsaw from BBC Monitoring looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Huge numbers of people in Sudan are struggling to find food as the country's civil war rages on, amid bleak warnings that it faces the deadliest famine since Ethiopia in the early 1980s. Both sides, the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, have been accused of hampering the distribution of desperately needed aid. Dr. Yazir Elamin of the Sudanese American Physicians Association has just returned from visiting his childhood home in Omdurman, across the Nile from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. And he's been talking to James Copnell.
In one of the hospitals there, I witnessed 2-3 children sharing one bed. These children are skin on bone. They are fighting for their lives. I witnessed the extreme difficult circumstances that doctors and nurses are working under. You could hear bombing in the background, very limited resources, and yet they're doing what they can to try to save these children. Hunger is the number one disease in Sudan, there is no doubt about it. And also, I witnessed how many organizations, including our own, in partnership with UNICEF, trying to support these hospitals that are incredibly underfunded. This is my second time in Sudan since the war erupted. This time, my sense of lawlessness and instability was greater. Many, many civilians have taken up arms. There are multiple checkpoints that are set up by civilians wearing civilian clothes and carrying out Kalashnikovs. That was a worrying feature. Part of that is the fact that when the paramilitary group, the RSF, took over Jazeera, there was a lot of indiscriminate killing. So based on that, a lot of the population felt that they were let down by the army and that they needed to defend themselves. So that's why you see this widespread carrying of guns, and inevitably along the lines of ethnic and tribal origin.
In terms of the medical care and those malnourished children you spoke about sharing a bed, would I be right in assuming that, dire and terrible though their situation is, they are perhaps the lucky ones, that other children simply aren't able to reach a hospital?
Yes, of course. Access is one of the biggest issues in Sudan now, access to medical care. And this is actually going to get aggravated by the rainy season. So remote parts of Sudan, and particularly Darfur and Kordofan, which are in the western and the southern part of the country, are going to be unreachable. So this is, again, going to, as I said, exaggerate the situation a lot.
I wonder what it felt like for you personally. You're from Omdurman, I think, originally, aren't you? Seeing it again, seeing streets you knew well, totally disfigured by the conflicts, how that made you feel?
It was kind of very, very emotional for me to go back to streets where I grew up. My father passed away 3 years ago, so I visited that area. It was incredibly emotional. We all know the numbers, but seeing the reality there, the hungry kids, the desperate doctors, I felt that there was no path forward.
Dr. Yazir Elamin. Over the past 8 months of war in Gaza, more than 330,000 tons of rubbish has built up in stinking piles dotted across the territory. Humanitarian agencies say the waste poses a catastrophic risk to the health of people already weakened by war, displacement and deprivation, and the shattered environment. Many people who fled the Israeli military offensive in the southern city of Rafah are now living beside these tips. And with temperatures soaring in the summer heat, the problem's getting worse, as our Middle East correspondent Yulia Nell reports.
War-torn Gaza has a new landscape with mountains of rubbish. They've built up as basic services have collapsed. And for many, like Asmahan al-Masri, this wasteland is now home.
We've never lived next to rubbish. I cry just like any other grandmother would over her grandchildren being sick and having scabies.
Asmahan's family of 16 is squeezed into a tent next to a temporary rubbish dump in Khan Yunis. They share their tent with clouds of flies, sometimes snakes. Everyone complains of the stench.
The smell is very disturbing. I keep my tent door open so that I can get some air, but there's no air, just the smell of rubbish.
More than a million people have been newly displaced by Israel's military assault on Rafah. As they've fled elsewhere in southern and central Gaza, many have found the only places left to live are next to rubbish.
We looked everywhere for a place for our kids and grandkids. We couldn't find one. There was nowhere where 18 people could stay.
Ali Nasser and his family come from Rafah.
My children have no jobs, no income. The waste causes diseases. We suffer from vomiting, diarrhea, and constantly itchy skin.
Local councils in areas that people have fled to say they've been overwhelmed. They lack equipment and fuel for rubbish trucks. Since the deadly 7th of October attacks, Israel has blocked access to the border area where Gaza's main landfill sites are. Sam Rose is from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
You see as you drive round, we drive round in our armoured vehicle, so the glass is very thick, but you can see the flies, you can see the dogs, piles high, kind of 5-6 metres high, 100-150 metres long, of just, you know, increasingly large and pretty disgusting piles of garbage.
Now, as summer temperatures soar, there are new warnings from aid agencies about the health hazards posed by so much rubbish. But desperation drives children like Mohammed, who's displaced near Deir al-Balah, to take extra risks, searching for something to eat, use or sell in the new dumps.
We got used to the horrible smell. Every day we come here together to search for cardboard, boxes and other things that can be burnt to make fire.
And across Gaza, these stinking piles of waste are a symbol of just how unbearable conditions here have become.
Yolan Nell reporting. Across the world, the past few days have provided stark reminders of the potential dangers of climate change. In Saudi Arabia, more than 500 people are believed to have died in Mecca as a result of extreme heat as they took part in the annual Hajj pilgrimage. While in the United States, tens of millions of people are bracing themselves for a possible record-breaking heat wave. They're just two examples from the global temperature maps scoured by the BBC weather presenter Chris Fawkes.
This is quite a typical thing that I see every single day in my job. If you look at this, the vast majority of places around the world have temperatures above average. And in those places that we've picked out, the eastern side of the United States, well, there's South America, a lot of that is above average. Africa, Middle East, Europe, the northeast of Russia. What we see is when it gets hot, temperatures are often a long way above average. There are still some cool areas, parts of Argentina, Mexico, central parts of Russia. But often the areas that are a little bit cooler than average are only just a bit cooler than average. And if you look at the overall global picture, there are far more parts of the world that are seeing above average temperatures than below. And that is the fingerprint of global warming that we see.
Simon Gosling, Professor of Climate Risks at the University of Nottingham, says it's a reminder that climate change is real.
That global pattern is driven by the global climate system, which over recent decades, we've changed quite significantly from what they were largely, but going back to pre-industrial times. So over the past 100 years and more, Greenhouse gas emissions from human activity have essentially started pushing the climate into a new state that we've not really seen before in human history at all. So many of the changes are driving the conditions we see at the moment. There's evidence showing now that the way humans are altering the climate system is affecting really big climate circulations like the jet stream. Also big systems that many of us will have heard of, like El Nino and La Nina, for instance, which also are responsible for the day-to-day weather we get, but also the extreme events that we see, like the heat waves that we're seeing currently in the US, also that we're seeing having those effects on death tolls in Mecca at the moment right now. Those are driven by some very big large-scale climate systems that we're essentially altering through greenhouse gas emissions that are going into the atmosphere and in turn the greenhouse effect. The difference between what would have happened if we'd not been emitting greenhouse gases and the situation that we're in now where we have been is that those individual extreme events are becoming more severe. So the heat waves we're starting to see are becoming hotter. An example would be the situation that we're seeing in Saudi Arabia at the moment. Okay, the temperatures there are well above what they should be. The typical average temperature of this time of year is in the low 40s. Okay, it's around about 42, 43 degrees. There's reports in some areas of the region that temperatures have hit about 51 degrees. Okay, so about 8 degrees higher than what they should be for this time of year. And in a way, that typifies the effects of global warming. Individual extreme events like heat waves basically get hotter. The other thing that we see is that those kind of extreme events become more frequent.
Simon Gosling of Nottingham University. A group of US lawmakers have met the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader the Dalai Lama at his monastery in northern India. The administration of President Joe Biden has recently stepped up its engagement on the Tibet issue. Our South Asia editor and Barasan Etherajan has more details.
The visit by the American lawmakers is part of an attempt by Washington to re-engage with Tibet amid increasing tensions with Beijing. It follows the passage of a bill by the U.S. Congress that seeks to encourage China to hold talks with Tibetan leaders that have been frozen since 2010. President Biden is expected to sign the bill soon. Ahead of the meeting, the Chinese embassy in Delhi said the Dalai Lama was a political exile engaged in anti-China activities.
And Barasan Etherajan. And finally, one of the smelliest plants on earth has bloomed at the world-famous Kew Botanical Gardens in London. To find out more about the aptly named corpse flower, Emma Barnett has been talking to Paul Rees, who's head of Kew's Tropical Nursery.
So it's Amorphophallus titanum, which is a plant in the Araceae family, and it's come into bloom. They don't bloom that regularly. Probably this one I think bloomed about 2 or 3 years ago. And when it's in bloom, it's a very large structure. This one's measures about 2.3 meters tall from the sort of top of the compost to the top of the bloom. And when it's in its peak, it smells really bad. It's like an animal's crawled into the glasshouse and died in the corner. It's a really strong, foul stench.
Did you all gather round to have a sniff?
Yeah, many people I think stuck their head into it and to have a good smell. I think you probably only do it once or twice,
and then you're done, and you remember it. It's funny how you can really remember smells. Why does it need to smell? What's the function of it?
It's primarily to be pollinated. So plants attract pollinators in order to get cross pollination to get them to set seed. And the Amorphophallus smells like rotting meat to attract its pollinators, which are probably mostly sort of carrion flies and potentially carrion beetles that would go normally to a rotting corpse and then lay their eggs sort of in amongst the corpse, and then the maggots would then feed on the corpse. So the Titanomerum sort of tricks these flies to come visit it, and in the process get covered in pollen and transfer pollen onto the female flowers. It's not actually a single flower. It's what's known as an inflorescence. So it's actually, it looks like one single flower, but actually if you looked inside, you find there's lots of small male flowers and female flowers sort of at the base of it.
And are people still able to come now? Is it still in full stench?
Yes, so it's a very short flowering event. So they're not normally sort of only last between sort of 36 to maybe 48 hours. So it opened yesterday morning, sort of mid morning to lunch. So today this I haven't seen it this morning, but today it will still be open, and then probably by tomorrow it would be on its way sort of closing.
In full stench, great phrase. That was Paul Rees talking there to Emma Barnett. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Jack Wilfen, and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.